Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this public lecture this afternoon on the maritime treaty context of Idle No More. This afternoon, we're going to hear from Dr. John Reed, who's a professor at St. Mary's University. He's a senior research fellow at the Gorsbrook Institute at St. Mary's. And Professor Reed has extensive experience working in the 17th and 18th century Northeast. He's the author of, well, almost more than a dozen books, perhaps, single authored, edited collections, as well as a couple works of fiction. I did want to point out a recent publication that he and Donald Savoie put together a couple of years ago now called Shaping an Agenda for Atlantic Canada. It's an edited collection by a number of scholars around Atlantic Canada. And Professor Reed has also been involved in a number, as an expert witness, in a number of court cases involving Aboriginal and treaty rights. And so we thought it was appropriate to invite him here to Acadia this afternoon to provide some historical context to the Idle No More movement and the history of the Mi'kmaq, Wolstoqiyik, Passamaquoddy, and Abenaki people in Maritime Canada and northeastern New England. And so without any further ado, I'd like to invite Professor Reed to the podium to give today's lecture.
Well, thank you very much indeed, and I'd like to begin by thanking Dr. Peace for making the arrangements for this visit to Acadia, and I know also that the Indigenous Student Society has been very much involved, and I'm very grateful to them and to them for their sponsorship. Let me begin by saying that it's always a pleasure to come to Acadia. I have spoken in this room before. And I've also visited classes over the years and had wonderful discussions with students. And so to be invited here is a tremendous privilege and something that I look forward to, as I have done this time. So the maritime treaty context of the Idle No More movement. What I'd like to begin by doing is just to make a few comments about the Idle No More movement. And I should say that I am a historian. I don't claim real expertise on this very important movement, especially since the situation that has been unfolding for the past number of weeks is such a pattern that changes and evolves and is extremely fluid. And so what I'd like to do is just to make a few preliminary comments about the movement, more with a view to starting us all on the same page, as it were, than pretending to any particular expertise on my part. What I then would like to do is to get into the maritime treaty background, to review briefly the treaty signings that have taken place in the Maritimes, all of them in the 18th century, although, as the court cases have shown in much more recent years, these are treaties that retain a very great significance in the 21st century and have been shown and adjudicated by the Supreme Court of Canada to be in existence now, just as they were in the 18th century. So that'll be the second area that I want to take a look at. And then, thirdly and finally, I want to make a few concluding comments as to what the maritime treaties might have to tell us that would be relevant to Idle No More and understanding the progress and the likely future progress of the movement. And also, what I would hope from those closing comments that I'll make in a few minutes, is that they might bring about some discussions, some comments, some possibly questions, but also thoughts and contributions from everybody. And so what I'm thinking is that I would like to think that we might have maybe half an hour or so for a discussion, that we can have a more freewheeling kind of exchange. So that's sort of the plan, and let me begin with those few comments on Idle No More. I'm sure we can all agree that the I Don't Know More movement, the development of the movement, the evolution of the movement, is an extremely important turn of events. The pattern of the movement, as I mentioned a moment ago, is still very new. It shows no sign of losing energy, and no doubt there are twists and turns that are still to be taken in the way in which the movement will develop, and in the way in which responses will be generated from indigenous people and also from non-indigenous people. And it's very interesting already to see the variety of responses that have been generated in the media, particularly to this movement. I think, for example, of the article by Andrew Coyne in the National Post a few days ago that interpreted I Don't Know More provocatively, and I think inaccurately, but very interestingly, as essentially a contest among indigenous groups, between people who have quite different visions of the future of indigenous peoples. And then what in effect was a response by Hayden King, in effect arguing that differences of opinion, differences of approach, diversities are not only inevitable in not just a group, but in a series of groups of people, such as indigenous people in this country, and that these divergences are not only inevitable, but also healthy. And arguing in conclusion that, you know, this is not disunity so much as democracy. So, again, there are very interesting dialogues that have essentially been spin-offs from the movement, but are inseparable, I think, from the way in which the movement has continued to evolve. Now, just picking up on that last point, one of the first points that perhaps is not fully appreciated by all non-Indigenous people in this country is just the sheer complexity and diversity of Indigenous cultures. There are, I hope I'm reasonably up-to-date and accurate, approximately 60 indigenous languages that are still spoken as living languages. There are, of course, are others that have ceased to be spoken. But there are about 60 that are spoken as living languages, some by larger numbers of people than others, but a large number of linguistic communities. Clearly, there are differences, and this is sort of basic, between First Nations, Inuit, and Métis, and in the wake of the recent federal court ruling on Métis rights, clearly that kind of spectrum of Indigenous people is becoming even more significant and more important than it was even a couple of weeks ago, and we await, no doubt, further legal clarification of that. The 2006 census showed a total population classified as Aboriginal of 1.2 million. And in terms that includes First Nations, Inuit, and Métis. That represents, if you want to take it as a proportion of the population of Canada, and obviously there are complexities in terms of the degree to which you reckon Indigenous populations as part of a Canadian population. But if you want to calculate it that way, that is something like 3.8%. That's not an outstandingly large number in percentage terms if you compare it, for example, with the Maori population in New Zealand, which stands at about 15%. And yet, 3.8%, 1.2 million people, for loose comparison by my count, there are 30 members, or approximately 30 members of the United Nations that have a smaller population than that. So is it a huge population in terms of the overall population on this land? Well, no. In 2013 it isn't. But is it a very substantial population that historically and in contemporary terms has outstanding significance? Well, yes, of course it is. And so that is part, I think, along with the diversity of why for indigenous and non-indigenous people, a movement that emerges, such as Idle No More, that has such wide support within a very important community, is something that cannot be ignored or treated as anything but important. One further observation about the indigenous population, that is that it tends to be a very young population. Again, taking 2006 figures of the Aboriginal population classified as such in the census, some 46% are age 24 or under, and no doubt by 2013, and no doubt the 2011 census will confirm that the youth population is no doubt even larger than that today than it was in 2006. So it is no surprise in that sense that a movement should emerge that clearly, while it's not confined to any one age group, does have enormous influence by young people, and young people who, in terms of their communications, in terms of the way they look at the world, are very much characterized by the kind of social media-based communication that's common to young people very widely. And in that sense, Idle No More has been compared often to the Occupy movement, and you could compare it to other important movements that have emerged internationally in recent years. So, the Idle No More movement, then, is a reflection, in a sense, of the indigenous population. It also is a movement that has been described by some commentators in the media and elsewhere as being diffuse and poorly focused. Now, clearly, there is a complexity in what we find in terms of current situations, in the sense that Idle No More is one movement. Chief Teresa Spencer's hunger strike is another dimension of developments that are ongoing, and the actions of not only the Assembly of First Nations, but others who may diverge from the Assembly of First Nations in terms of their approach to tactics and strategy, mean that there is a complexity, and again, that reflects, I would suggest to you, that kind of healthy diversity that I mentioned a few moments ago. The key organizers of Idle No More have been, it seems to me, abundantly clear. They made it clear that their concerns are in part environmental, and that they're objecting to the weakening of environmental safeguards, that their concerns also have to do with governance and the slipping into much larger pieces of legislation by the federal government, of very important pieces of legislation that have had little or no consultation with Indigenous people or even with the appropriate parliamentary committee. But most of all, and the organizers again have been very, very consistent on this, Idle No More is about the relationship and about resetting a relationship of respect and dialogue between Indigenous people and particularly the representatives of the Crown. And that brings the movement directly into the realm of treaties. Because treaties really in this country are the formal basis of relationships between Indigenous people and the Crown. The treaties that are most often cited are the number treaties, the ones that involve areas much further west than here, in western parts of central Canada and parts, large parts of the West and North that were signed between 1871 and 1921. These numbered treaties involved a vast amount of territory, and generally speaking, they included territorial surrender. And yet, they're also very diverse in terms of the provisions that they have, and all of them put obligations on the Crown, meaning in this context the federal government. Now, the obligations are not the same, they're variable. But these are treaties that do involve land, but they also involve obligations taken on by the Crown to contribute to the economic well-being of indigenous people, and a variety of these responsibilities that the Crown then took over. Now, the number treaties are obviously extremely important, but much less often referenced, and here's where I come to a central element of my talk this afternoon, much less often referenced, but extremely significant, at least in my view, and I hope to convince you accordingly, are the peace and friendship treaties, entered into by the Crown with the Mi'kmaq, Wolstukwiuk, or Maliseet, and Passamaquoddy peoples between 1725 and 1779. Although these treaties are seldom referenced in the current discussions by comparison with the number of treaties, these treaties are, I would suggest to you, foundational in the sense that they were the earliest treaties between the Crown and Indigenous peoples within what became Canada, and because they have certain very distinctive elements that have, and in many cases, been adjudicated by the Supreme Court, but in some cases have yet to be either litigated or fully negotiated. Now, I'm not going to enumerate all the treaties one by one, because we'd be here for a long time and it probably wouldn't be productive. But what I do want to summarize is that the earliest of the treaties, 1725, was signed, or at least the earliest form of it was signed, in Boston. It was negotiated by negotiators who were not Mi'kmaq or Wolstukwiuk or Passamaquoddy. They were, in fact, Penobscot from the northeastern part of the state of Maine. And what they reflect is that these treaties come out of a broader stream of treaty making that involved all of the Wabanaki peoples of the northeast, and that really go back certainly as far as the Treaty of 1678, and you can, further back than that, it becomes a bit less easy to define. Some people would argue that the treaty-making process goes back longer than that. But you can certainly date it from 1678. So this is a process that dates from very early in the process of settler colonization, in fact, before settler colonization really began in the area that we know as the Maritimes. And it is a process that evolved over a long period of time. The 1725 treaty, negotiated in Boston, was then brought back, and a ceremonial ratification took place in what the British called Nova Scotia, and another one in what the British also called Nova Scotia, but later would become New Brunswick. And that all took until 1728. And then there were further treaties, one in 1749 at the founding of Halifax, one in 1752 that followed the violent conflict brought about by the founding of Halifax, other treaties in 1760 and 61 that came during the Seven Years' War and immediately after the fall of Louisbourg, and then a further treaty in 1779 during the American Revolution. Now, what does all this tell us? Let me make a couple of general observations and then get into some of the more specific elements of what the treaties say. and notes I use the present tense because these are treaties that are still valid. So, a couple of general comments. First of all, that these are treaties that tended to be made at a time when peace was required. The history of relationships between indigenous people and what we know as the Maritimes and imperial representatives was a troubled history, and it was characterized at times by diplomacy, at times by conflict. And so the treaties, the specific treaties, tend to belong to time when there has been conflict and when peace is going to be restored. Second general comment, that these are treaties explicitly of peace and friendship. You know, the exact terms vary, but what they represent is peace and friendship between indigenous representatives and indigenous peoples and the crown. Peace and friendship really is the key, I think, to understanding this relationship. So what did the treaties say? Well, the treaties, as I say, differed, although they all have a lot in common. All of them looked forward to trading relationships. There's an economic dimension to these treaties, that trade would take place between indigenous communities and non-natives. The written texts of the treaties include statements of submission to the British Crown. But what I would caution is that when you really submit these particular articles of the treaties to hard historical analysis, what emerges, certainly what I've argued, and there are others who have argued differently, what emerges is that there clearly was a difference of understanding in that regard. Because if you look, if you interpret the treaties in the context of later statements by indigenous leaders, it becomes very clear that that really is not their understanding. And so essentially what you have is treaties between one side that gives prime significance to the written context, another side that has oral record keeping as the major form of understanding. And therefore, you have to, I think, allow for scope for differential understanding. But however you interpret them, these statements are in the treaties. Often the treaties will provide for prisoner exchange. That's a very basic and literal kind of element of the treaties after conflict. But the most important parts, I think, of the treaties are, number one, that they involve no land surrender. It's just not there. They're the closest you get is provisions in the treaties that lawful settlement, for example, in the 1725 treaty, that the British, if they make settlements that are lawfully made, and it's not quite defined by whose law, then they will be accepted and tolerated. But in terms of a general land surrender, it's just not there. And that clearly is an important point of ongoing negotiation, which we'll get to in a moment. So there's no land surrender. But the values, and remember, I Don't Know More is all about relationships. You know, it's about other things as well, but that's a consistent theme of I Don't Know More, is a respectful relationship. And that's exactly what the Maritime Treaties embody as the highest and most prominent value. These are treaties of peace and friendship. And interestingly, that is an area, I mean, clearly there is scope in these treaties. Now, these are treaties between peoples who are very different. Culturally, they're very different. In terms of societal organization, they're very different. And there are certain areas where, undoubtedly, that leads to differential understanding. So I've already alluded to one. And yet, when you get to peace and friendship, and peace
is reasonably self-evident, especially when the treaty comes after conflict. But friendship is, I think, a very interesting kind of point of intersection between these two very different cultures. In indigenous cultures, this is true of the Wabanaki, it's true of other predominantly Algonquian-speaking peoples in eastern North America, no doubt more widely as well. But friendship is symbolized by gift-giving. If you have a friendly, and that means a respectful relationship as well, it's not just friendship in the sense of, you know, the 21st century sense that you're good buddies, you like to hang out together. This is more than that. I mean, it's a respectful relationship that can be expected to be ongoing. And incidentally, it's a relationship also that needs nurturing. Friendship can't just, you can't just say, well, you're my friend, and then not go on Facebook for 2 years. I mean, it's a lot more than that. It's a deeper kind of thing. You have to nurture this relationship. And the giving of gifts from an indigenous point of view is very central to doing that. But also from the British point of view. Now, I'm not saying there aren't differences in this area as well, but if you really examine 18th century British concepts of friendship, they're really quite compatible. And here you have two very different cultures that do come together on this value. Friendship in the 18th century British context, again, is not something that depends on, you know, essentially social interaction. I mean, that might be part of it. But, I might have a neighbor who I like to have coffee with, and I have nice conversations for 20 years, but in the 18th century sense, I might not count that person as my friend. Because a friend is somebody who you might get along well with socially, but essentially somebody who has a stake in your well-being. So you might count family members as friends in that sense. It's somebody with whom you share a deep bond that really does extend to reciprocal interest, you know, reciprocal interest that goes beyond just the fact that you like them. And so when the two sides talk about friendship, I mean, they're both saying something very significant about the relationship. And every Nova Scotia governor of the 18th century had a specific instruction that enjoined that person, that in effect instructed that person, literally instructed them, to maintain friendship with indigenous peoples. Now, I mean, everybody knew the path was not always smooth, that conflict could arise. But every governor was instructed to, quote, enter into treaty with indigenous nations. In the territory that then was defined as Nova Scotia, which included the current New Brunswick. And so what I would suggest is that these 18th century treaties really do embody a meeting of values. What I would also suggest is that unlike the suggestion that's sometimes made, they were not dictated treaties. Now, I should come clean on this. I mean, there is a debate that's ongoing, and among historians, that's always a good thing when historians debate, because that's how we advance historical understanding. And, there are colleagues whom I respect, who would argue that really, especially in terms of the 1660 and 1760, 1761 treaties, that, the Mi'kmaq, Wastukwiuk and Passamaquoddy people had really been exhausted by the conflict that had taken place, and also now no longer, since the fall of Louisbourg, had their French ally. And therefore, that they really were submitting, that it was literally true, that they were submitting to the British. And people such as Stephen Patterson, John Grenier, historians whom I have great respect for, have argued that way. I would respectfully argue that the truth is quite different. In reality, while these indigenous nations needed peace in 1761. Nevertheless, that the British needed peace as well. Because the British bridgehead, if I can put it that way, in Meemaki, which was primarily Halifax and some other places, and then later, of course, planter settlement, largely but not exclusively in areas that had been Acadian, the British were still vulnerable to the military pressure, particularly Mi'kmaq forces, and that they were under no illusions that they needed peace. And, therefore, peace and friendship made abundant sense in that situation. So what I would suggest is that the treaties are genuine treaties, that they were negotiated, that they were representative peace and friendship that both sides needed, and both sides were willing to undertake in all seriousness.
So, the relationship, therefore, is crucial to the peace and friendship treaties. Now,
time doesn't permit to go over all the developments that, in effect, fairly quickly eroded the friendship that was embodied in the treaties. The process of settler colonization led to dispossession. There was no land surrender, but there was dispossession, particularly the Loyalist era, and then larger, later waves of migration meant that by 1820, for example, the colony of Nova Scotia was identifying reserves in each county. And already in New Brunswick, which quite now existed, in New Brunswick too, reserves on a more sort of ad hoc, haphazard basis had been delineated. The indigenous economy was more and more disrupted. Important transportation nodes were cut off. Areas that were significant for harvesting of resources were taken over by agricultural settlement, that most desperately destructive form of invasion that just absolutely ground to nothing the environmental basis of so much of the indigenous economy. By the middle of the 19th century, reserves were being eroded by frequently, especially in New Brunswick, by sales to non-indigenous people without indigenous approval. Tuberculosis had appeared as a characteristic disease of people who were forced into small spaces with very little ability to subsist. So all of these matters eroded the relationship. And I should add that really was reflected in terms of the understanding of the non-indigenous state that now represented the crown, which began to behave much more as if a conquest had taken place, which of course was never the historical reality. And yet, not only were written copies of the treaties handed down in indigenous families, but also the oral record was kept alive. And with the new constitution in 1982 and its recognition of Aboriginal and treaty rights, that became a much more alive, in terms of the non-indigenous view of things, a much more alive kind of way of looking at the treaties, and that was confirmed in a number of court cases, we'll go over them in detail, and by adjudications of the Supreme Court of Canada.
So what I suggest to you, and I'm beginning to move now to more concluding observations, is that the peace and friendship treaties, which so long were overlooked on the non-indigenous side, and even today in the context of at least media commentary on I Owe No More, are not nearly as often referenced as other treaties, particularly the Umber treaties. And yet, in a very real sense, the peace and friendship treaties
embodied. And remember, they still exist today. They're not just historical relics. I mean, they've been adjudicated to still exist. Really have embodied the kind of relationship, even though that relationship has not been historically honored for a long time. Nevertheless, they have embodied that relationship that, in many respects, I Know No More is all about, the resetting of a respectful relationship. Now, to be sure, in Nova Scotia, there is a process underway of negotiation, sometimes referred to as the tripartite process, sometimes referred to as the Maiden Nova Scotia process, by which the indigenous negotiators from the Mi'kmaq Rights Initiative meet regularly and negotiate with people from both federal and provincial levels of the state. And nobody pretended that that would be a quick or easy process, and it isn't. And yet it has gone through a number of important milestone agreements, and it is ongoing. And so, in that sense, the Peace and Friendship Treaties, in certain respects, you can say, perhaps are being honored in 2013, have been for some years, but it will be a long process. So, where does all this take us, very briefly, because I'm going on and on here, I got carried away, I need to leave some time for discussion. What I suggest is that the treaties, the Peace and Friendship Treaties, are important for the rights recognized in them, for the lack of land surrender, but also for the relationship that peace and friendship is so central to these treaties. Exactly what that means in terms of negotiation is going to take a long time to sort out. And yet, I Don't Know More, in so many ways, is about youth. And many of the most urgent issues facing Indigenous nations are about youth. Not only because youth is such a large part of the population, but also because of the many social issues and environmental issues that face so many Indigenous communities. Chief Spencer's community would be just one example. So many of them bear very hard on youth. And that gives urgency. So you've got the long-term process of sorting out rights and treaties. You've also got the shorter-term issues that people are, young people are dying, to put it not to put a fine point on it, that lends urgency to the entire process. But what I do suggest that I Owe No More has been crucially important. You would say that the Occupy movement was crucially important in identifying certain key inequities that really were brought into the widespread public mind uniquely by that movement. So I Don't Know More is making everyone aware, not just Indigenous people, but non-Indigenous as well, of the need for a respectful relationship, perhaps to put it in a different way, but meaning exactly the same, perhaps for peace and friendship. And as a final thought, and this is not original to me, because Jim Miller, Professor James Miller, has been saying this for a long time, perhaps I Don't Know More also brings to our attention the reality that this is, or should be, a treaty country. It is a country that, again, to refer briefly to New Zealand, in which I'm no expert and which I'm not idealizing, but in New Zealand, there is essentially one treaty, the Treaty of Waitangi in 1840, that has taken, well, it's not a constitution as such, it's now universally recognized as a founding document of that country. The complication in Canadian terms is that there is a kind of uneven picture across the country. You have the earliest treaties, peace and friendship, in what we know as the Maritimes.
and you know, maybe they extend in certain senses to part of Quebec, to part of Newfoundland, but even that is a matter of debate. So the Peace and Friendship Treaties in the Maritimes. You have a whole patchwork of treaties of many different kinds in the old Lower and Upper Canada, essentially Central Canada as we know it. You have the numbered treaties, which are later and different, obviously incredibly important, but different. And then, in Newfoundland and Labrador and British Columbia, in effect, you have no treaties. And, you know, negotiations in British Columbia have been ongoing for a long time. So rather than having one foundational document, in Canadian terms, there's a whole series of different situations in treaty terms. And yet I would suggest, as a closing thought, that, while it complicates matters, it doesn't change the reality that this needs to be a treaty country, a country where, although I'm well aware there are many Indigenous leaders who think it's not possible, where a real degree of reconciliation can be achieved that will allow Indigenous and non-Indigenous alike to go forward with the kind of respectful relationship that I Don't Know More is drawing to our attention and advocating every day.
So we have some time for questions. I'll moderate our discussion period so that we respect both Dr. Reed's time and your time. But if there are any questions, now would be the time for them.
Yeah. I had a question about, you were talking about treaties, and I was wondering, like, you were talking about how, like, in New Zealand they have one treaty that spans the whole country. Do you think for somewhere like Canada it's better to get people talking about the treaties that already exist and renegotiate them, or what you said, come up with a new treaty altogether, I guess?
Well, I think probably both. You know, that's a weaselly answer to the question. I think it's very important to have had the kind of adjudication that we've had from the Supreme Court of Canada. And, these cases presumably are not finished yet, although certainly in terms of the maritime cases, I suspect that litigation, now that negotiation is taking over more, litigation will be less significant. But litigation, what the courts do, essentially, is to look back at what existed historically and then to interpret it in terms of current legal realities. So that kind of recognition of existing treaties, I think certainly is really important, because what you can't do is to overlook or reduce existing treaty rights or existing Aboriginal rights for that matter. But there's no question, I think, that negotiation is needed, to encompass situations that, are 21st century situations. I'm not at all expert on either Newfoundland, Labrador, or British Columbia, but the British Columbia process has been ongoing. I mean, there are those who, grumble that it's been very slow and unproductive, and well, perhaps it has, but then these are problems that have taken a very long time to emerge. In the Maiden Nova Scotia process, here again is an example where, people are talking about historical realities, and we are talking about, a situation, a process that has deep historical roots that you can't ignore, but are very much talking about it in terms of the future. And so I think that, probably what has to happen is that there has to be a respectful recognition that this is a relationship that is rooted in the past, but it's one that really is all about the future, and that has to guide, present-day negotiation.
Any Any other questions?
Yeah. I was wondering, was there really like a genuine friendship on the treaties on behalf of the British, or was it only a circumstantial friendship just to achieve what was wanted in that time?
Yeah. Well, I think in some ways it depends who you're dealing with. I think that in terms of the British in the 18th century, there were British imperial representatives, British officers, who were here for a long time, who really did understand realities of what was taking place among communities, among indigenous communities, Acadian communities, and the British presence. And I hesitate in the presence of the expert on Paul Mascarene to cite that name, but it seems to me, and I'm subject to correction here, that Mascarene would be one example of a person who had an understanding of interrelationships, and was an officer with imperial responsibilities, but did have an understanding of the way in which the British presence had to be a negotiated presence. Now, there are others, particularly later governors, who didn't operate that way, and who found it very difficult to think of indigenous people as anything but, you know, people who had been subordinated to the British Crown. So that there is, I think, a real element of pragmatism in the British view, that the treaties of 1760 and 61, I think, were genuinely negotiated treaties, but the British were under no illusion that they needed that. And so it really was, I think, a matter of need, and of course, the submission clauses appeared in the written versions. But there still were people, I think, who didn't operate that way. And another complex figure would be George Henry Monk, who was the Nova Scotia Commissioner of Indian Affairs in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, who also was, you know, an imperial and colonial in the sense of provincial person who had, you know, allegiances and responsibilities that way. But Monk, for example, not only had many uncomfortable meetings with Mi'kmaq people, and they would be pretty blunt with George Henry Monk about, you know, the relationship and how it was evolving. But also Monk referred, there's one letter that really kind of sticks out to me, and I don't think it's ever really been kind of deconstructed and examined for its significance. But Monk referred to, specifically Mi'kmaq in this letter, as, quote, the aboriginal proprietors of this land. Well, that's an interesting statement. And it's the kind of thing, I think, that reflects the reality that while it's not wrong to say, as I've just said, that the British interest was pragmatic. And, you know, that does reflect, again, sort of the emergence into the 19th century of a different role for the colonial state, which we'll come to in a second. But it's always a complex relationship. There are people, even among imperial officials, who understand the relationship and understand it in a way that's a lot more subtle than that would imply. Now, I think a real turning point comes, all dates are arbitrary and this kind of thing, but you would kind of say about 1815 with the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the War of 1812, 1814, when the British are no longer feeling acute military pressures. And where the colonial state begins to operate in a different way, that the state becomes very non-interventionist in many ways in the kind of day-to-day relationship of indigenous and non-indigenous people, which really means that the state, in effect, tacitly endorses things like, you know, encroachment on reserves, that kind of thing. And once you get to that point, then the crown has ceased to operate in a way that resembles the friendship clauses of the 18th century instructions. All this is a long-winded way of saying that, yes, it's pragmatic, but I think until the British stop feeling the military pressure as much, there also are elements of a more genuine adoption of the policy of friendship. But remember that friendship, again, is not necessarily, a warm friendship, but it's a friendship in the sense of recognizing the need for give and take, the need for gifts, and the way that coexistence works in that sense.
We have time for maybe one more question. Yep.
I was just wondering, how you didn't use the word poverty, you didn't use the word water in the discussion, and how do we draw that out of these friendships? And where do we, as a country, have a responsibility to adhere to water poverty?
Yep. Well, no, I mean, I certainly, I guess the reason that I did accept in terms of some of the urgency of the issues facing indigenous people today, is that, I think environment is a very crucial part of this 18th century relationship. And, the context of the treaties, at least in my interpretive view, and again, there's room for more debate on this in historical terms, but the treaties really emerge in a context where the British are very marginal in a geographical sense to Mi'kmaqi, and they really are present very little in the Wolstoqlik territory of Wolstoqlik of Maliseet. So that, in a sense, the British in this era of treaty making really threatened to make environmental change, because the minute you get widespread agricultural settlement, you have enormous change that extends to shrinkage of native economies, poverty, and eventually to taking over water, to putting up barriers for fisheries on waterways, to using waterways for timber transportation, and other ways that are not compatible with the native economy. But that, I think, is not a characteristic in serious terms of the treaty-making era. Certainly, you have the planters, extremely important settlement group, but one, at least as I've argued, and again, I hesitate to comment too much on the planters here in Acadia, because the if I can be so bold as to do so, I've argued that really the planter population in the treaty-making period really did not exceed the Acadian population pre-deportation, and in many respects it took over the same geographical areas. And Acadians and Mi'kmaqs, the other indigenous peoples, had, I won't say it was a relationship of total harmony between Acadians and indigenous people, but it was a relationship, generally speaking, that worked with some frictions, it seems, as the Acadian population grew. Those planter settlements, environmentally were limited and really didn't raise that environmental question so much as did the threat of more extensive settlement. Now, I would certainly argue that the conflicts that followed the establishment of Halifax did have to do with the recognition by Mi'kmaq leaders that something like Halifax threatened extensive settlement that had environmental consequences. But I don't think that threat, partly, perhaps largely because of Mi'kmaq diplomacy and to some degree Mi'kmaq military action, didn't really materialize at that point. But when it did, in the Loyalist era and later, then you really do start to see in conversations, for example, with George Henry Monk, that environmental issues are becoming very, very important to the Mi'kmaq spokespeople who are represented at surrounding records. But then especially, again, once you get beyond roughly 1815, that's when environmental issues are becoming crucial, and that's when the traditional economy is shrinking rapidly, when poverty, tuberculosis, use of water and other resources for opposed purposes to the indigenous economy really is becoming significant. But that too is the time when the value of friendship has in effect been abandoned by the colonial state, and so too really go together in that context.
Just before we leave, I'd like to invite two people to come up and thank Dr. Reed. First, I'd like to thank one of the co-founders of the Indigenous Students Association here at Acadia, Carrie, to come up and thank Professor Reed.
I would invite you to come back to Acadia in February and March to continue telling this story as an ongoing process, an ongoing talk that is completely necessary, not in terms of only legitimizing the talk that people are saying all across the country, of which people are saying and I get very frustrated when people say that what Indigenous people are not consistent, it's not legitimate, what they want is more than what they've already been given and this kind of thing. But I think what you provided is very important for me. And even though I'm not a Mi'kmaq from this local territory, I'm very happy that I'm able to be here and be educated at Acadia. I come from Rankin Inlet, Nunavut. I'm a Inuk from the northern part of the country. And so I come from away, but I think what you say is very relevant and consistent throughout the country, even though we are a country of treaties, multiple treaties, that they need to be recognized. And I almost wish that all the ministers that are involved in governing this country would be taught this so that they don't brush aside things that ignore that part of the history. And so I was wishing as soon as we walked in and I heard you speaking that I was like, wow, he's good. He's good. And I wish that your presentation was put on radio so that more Canadians can be educated about this and so that it is a slap in your face reminder. Hey, this is worth listening to. Hey, this is relevant. Hey, this is a part of our future, whether or not we choose to recognize it as such. And so I would invite you to come over and talk again. And we have a larger audience that will come and appreciate this kind of things as relevant as it is today.
And I'd also like to invite our resident expert in Paul Mascarene, the Dean of Arts, Barry Moody, to come up and thank Professor Reed on that.
Thank you very much, Tom. I was trying to think just before Dr. Reed began this afternoon how long ago I met Dr. Reed. It got to be a bit embarrassing, so I didn't go any further down that road. Let's just put it this way, that it's been quite a few years. Certainly, I think in excess of 35 years that we have known each other. He first started showing up at conferences here in the Maritimes, giving papers. And I think all of us were exposed to him even back then when he was just a sort of newly minted PhD. We knew that this was somebody on the go. This is somebody that was on his way up. And just to echo the previous speaker, I think even then we thought, wow, he is good. we recognized that even then. And because John and I are in somewhat, at least, sort of parallel touching fields anyway. He began really in sort of 17th century Maritimes. My specialty was 18th century Maritimes. Since it's a pretty small community of people interested in those topics, we ended up, of course, over the years at the same conferences. We have helped each other out occasionally. linkages between St. Mary's and Acadia. And so I've had a lot of opportunities over the years to listen to John, to read his work. We've presented at similar at the same conference frequently. So I've had an opportunity over the years to become even more impressed than I was even back there at the beginning. Impressed with his research, his erudition, but I think above all, his willingness, even his eagerness, to share that with diverse audiences, not just with academics, not just with his peers, other professors who might advance his career. He has taken his message, his knowledge out into in all sorts of different directions. Been so willing to share it over the years. And it's something I've always very much appreciated about John. Thank you very much for a very stimulating discussion this afternoon. I think we'll all go away thinking about peace and friendship and exactly what those terms really do mean and what they should mean. Hopefully we've also gained more context. If we try to understand any kind of movement, but let alone a movement like Idle No More, in the context of the present day, that's important. But I think we'll go badly astray if we think of it just as, 2013 kind of movement. It's so much more than that. And all of these things are so deeply rooted, in the past. And not just the past of someplace else in Canada, but as John has so well explained this afternoon, well rooted in the past right here in the Maritimes. And those treaties of the 18th century, so long sort of swept under the rug by our politicians, our legal experts, by all of us pretty well, more and more important in the last couple of decades. And John has played a very important role in making sure that those have become more and more important. And his role in that legal process has been a very, very pivotal one. So on your behalf, I would like to extend a very warm thank you to John for sharing with us this afternoon. And we do hope you will come back and come back soon. You don't come this way often enough. And we can't wait for another Planter conference to get you back here either. We need you back here more often than that. So thank you very, very much.